Hi, my name's Paul Grogan and welcome to episode 67 of the All New Gaming Rules podcast. This episode is an audio version of the live Q&A that went out in April 2024. A big thank you to all of my Patreon supporters for making these episodes possible, and if you want to support me directly, you can do so at patreon.com/gamingrules. And now, on with the show. Welcome to the live Q&A for April 2024. The chat is working. Omar's in the chat, excellent. James is here, Martin's here, Elaine's here, Rick's here, Team Arcanium is here, Tiggy's here, T Dory is here, we're all here, everybody's here, great, fantastic. So, as usual, we're going to be going through all of the questions that I've been asked in advance on the Board Game Geek Guild. That'll probably take about the first 40 minutes of the show, and then we'll hand over to the live questions. So if you're watching this video live and you do have any questions for me, put them in the chat. Start with the word question in capital letters. Vicky will spot those and she will transfer them into the document that we're going to use. Before we start, though, just a few things. Big thank you to all of my Patreon supporters for funding the channel. This video is not sponsored in any way and all of the advertising revenue goes to charity. And I'm only able to do that thanks to the support of the Patreon campaign. So, yeah, huge thank you to all of my Patreon supporters for your support. And if you like the content that I create and you want to support me directly, you can do so at patreon.com/gamingrules. Also, each month I do a giveaway. I give away £50 worth of games vouchers for Gameslore. So Gameslore provide £25 of those vouchers themselves and I provide the other £25 myself. So yeah, if you're watching this video either live or you're watching this video back afterwards, you can enter the contest to win £50 worth of vouchers from Gameslore. I'm always shocked by the small number of people that enter the contest. I mean, these videos are not massively popular. I do get about 1,000 people watching these videos, but we get about 60 people entering the contest. £50 of vouchers. You could win. All you need to do is enter the contest. There is a link in the chat right now, or there will be soon, to the contest. And all you need to do is click on there. Give us your name, your email address, which I won't keep. And I will do the draw at the start of next month. If you are one of my Patreon supporters, you get extra entries into the hat. So generally speaking, what normally happens is that maybe one every 3 or 4 months, it will be a non-Patreon supporter that win. But there is some weighting towards Patreon supporters just because without them, this channel and what I do is not possible. So yeah, hopefully a link will appear. It's in the description of the video as well if you can't find it. Have you put the contest link in? Okay, so the link is going to appear to the contest in a minute. Vicky's going to put that into the chat. Now, the question from last month, and I will give you the winner for last month. The winner from last month's contest was Lee, and I have contacted Lee, and Lee has received the email. So that's all good. So Lee has won £50 worth of games vouchers. Thank you very much, Lee, for your support. But Lee is a Patreon supporter of mine. But there was a winner from the previous month. So I don't know if you remember, but last month, I hadn't had time or I'd forgotten to do the draw before the actual show itself. So I did the draw. This is for February. I did the draw right after last month's live Q&A and Melinda Beavers won. Now, I've been trying to get in contact with Melinda and I've tried all sorts of different methods of contacting Melinda, email, Facebook, Discord and everything else. And I haven't been able to contact her. So on the off chance that if you are watching this video, Melinda, or you're listening to this as a podcast, or anybody knows Melinda, please get in contact with her and let her know that she won the live Q&A giveaway for February. If I've not heard anything back in the next few weeks, I will have to do that draw again. So, yes. Now, in terms of the contest for this month, all you need to do, I mean, it's not really a contest, it's just you need to enter in order to be able to win. The secret word this month is macaron. There you go. And I'm not going to tell you what it is or how to pronounce it. If you are one of my supporters and you are on our Slack channel, you will know what they are. But yeah, macaron is the password for this month, the secret word for this month. Right. Okay, so off we go. First question is from Adrian. Was there a point in your life that you got burnout from playing board games and creating content for it? So there's two different questions there, Adrian. Have I ever got burnout from playing board games? No. Have I ever got burnout from creating content? Yes and no. There have been times in the past where I've looked back and I've realized that there are certain things that I've done in order to try and produce content, and I've put a lot of effort into certain types of content that I've created that just didn't trigger. It wasn't worth it. And every time I get excited about a new idea, oh, I could do this. This would be exciting. People will want to watch this. Every time I try something new, it doesn't work. So I've kind of stopped doing that a bit, and I'm focusing on things which I want to do. I remember Essen, not last year, the year before, I got back from Essen and I decided that I was going to take 2 days off work and basically spend 2 days just doing unboxing videos. And I'd scheduled like 5 or 6 unboxing videos a day. And I spent 2 days, and all I did was on the hour, every hour for 2 days, pretty much just do unboxing videos of all of new games. I thought that would be cool. I thought that would be fun. I thought that would be exciting. It took me, not only did it take me those 2 days to do them, I had to create all the thumbnails, schedule all of the videos, do all of that sort of stuff. And it was a lot of time and effort, and the benefit of me doing that wasn't much. Now, some people watched those videos and it was fun at the time, but when I look back on things like that, I think, was it really worth spending 2 entire days where I could have been working, or I could have been doing a playthrough, or I could have been painting miniatures or something else, to just do unboxing videos when it just wasn't really worth it? So there are many, many things that I've done over the past which I occasionally should look at and think, it's not really burnout, because I still want to do those things. But when there is no real benefit to doing them and the audience is low and there's very little engagement in the videos, it's a bit disheartening, and it makes me kind of not want to do that again. So I've been trying to sort out for the last sort of 2 or 3 years, and I've been trying to balance my enthusiasm for creating content as for the amount of time and effort it's worth for whether it's actually worth it or not. And generally speaking, it hasn't been. So there we go. Hopefully that's answered the question. Next question from Ray. How is the refresher going for Roads and Boats? So Roads and Boats is an old game from 1999 that I bought myself as a retirement present when I gave up my previous career. And it's a really interesting game, and I haven't played it in a very long time. So I've agreed that I'm going to play it at Manicon this year. Manicon is a UK convention that I go to almost every year. I didn't go last year for various reasons. And I've got a game of it scheduled for Manicon this year, which is in July. And I've not played it in about 4 years. And Ray is asking, how is the refresher going? So what I've been doing is, at late nights while Vicky's gone to bed, I've been loading up YouTube and I've been watching videos on the reproductive systems of geese in the wild. I think that might make me a better player of the game, but that's all I've been doing at the moment, is just watching late night videos of geese reproducing. Next question from Mike. What, if any, board game YouTube and podcasts do you follow? I follow lots of them, but the reality is that I don't have that much time to watch them. So as I've spoken about many times before, I have very little free time with all of the work that I'm doing in the background, all of the content that I'm creating. I mean, at the moment, I'm going through a phase where I'm busy 4 evenings a week. There is only one evening a week where I actually have some time to myself, and that's when me and Vicky normally play Tenti Grail or watch a little bit of TV. So last week I was busy 4 nights. This week I'm busy 4 nights. So I don't actually have that much free time. Also, the nature of the work that I do, whether it be script writing, video editing, or anything like that, there's a lot of things where I can't have anything on in the background because it's just too distracting for me able to do the work. So I get very little time to myself. The only real downtime that I have to listen to anything or watch anything is when I go to the gym, which will be 3 or 4 times a week for about 30 to 40 minutes. And audiobooks is what I listen to. And because I like listening to audiobooks, and there's lots of audiobooks that I enjoy listening to, that's what I'm doing at the moment. I'm currently on the 3rd book of the Cthulhu case mysteries, which are Sherlock Holmes Cthulhu-y audiobooks that are really good, and I'm listening to them. So that means that I don't actually get enough time to watch other people's content very much. But there are certain people who, if I see that they've got a video on something, I will watch you know, I won't watch all of it, but I will watch a bit of it. So this isn't a full list, but here's just a few of them. Tom Heath from Slicker Drips, Rado, Nithranya, Board Games in a Nutshell for tutorial videos. By far, I think some of the best instructional videos out there. Mark Meyer from Board Game Coffee and his instructional videos are fantastic as well. Johannes and Sunova from Board Gaming Ramblings. Derek from Kanji Studios for live playthroughs. Greg from Solo Playthroughs as well. Mark Dainty from Solo Stuff. Mark Dainty does a lot of solo stuff. Meeple University. I watch their stuff now and again. Mike Dennis from Ready Steady Play. And I've even been known to watch some of Luke Hector's videos occasionally from that. There are loads of channels that I do enjoy their content. I just don't actively watch everything that any channel does. In terms of podcasts, it's really only the Board Game Barbecue podcast from the guys in Australia. And again, I don't listen to every single one because I simply don't have time, because my travel time is a few seconds. But they do a great podcast as well. Hang on, the phone's going. Yeah. It's JP from the Whose Turn Is It Anyway podcast. Yes, I also listen to the Whose Turn Is It Anyway podcast as well. Thank you, JP, for the reminder. So, yeah, Whose Turn Is It Anyway podcast as well is another one that I listen to. Next question from Keith. He says, if GridCon 6, bear with him, could occur anywhere in the UK apart from Taunton or Devon. I'm just going to go downstairs. There's a bit of a noise downstairs. It could be the cats. Well, it probably is the cats. Need to go and see what they're destroying. If it could occur anywhere in the UK, apart from Taunton or Devon, with zero admin stroke logistics stroke supplier stroke customer hassle. So in other words, we name it and it just all happens perfectly. Which location would you choose? It's a good question. And I find it difficult to answer these types of questions because I'm very much more of a pessimist stroke realist. I prefer the term realist. A lot of people call me a pessimist, but I prefer the term realist. So because that won't happen, it's difficult for me to think about that. But it wouldn't be the UK. It would be somewhere where there is gorgeous weather, basically. If I could name it anywhere, oh no, in the UK. Sorry, anywhere in the UK. Okay. I don't know. I don't know. What do you think in the chat? What do you think? Where would you like GridCon to be? And for those people who don't know, GridCon is the convention that me and Vicky organise ourselves, which is happening in November, and it's in Taunton. Yeah. Where would we like it to be if it just all happens perfectly? Possibly a castle somewhere? If there was like a big castle somewhere that had lots of gaming area, probably something like that. I think that would be quite cool. Everything okay downstairs? Okay, right. Next question from Neil. When you're playing a solo game with no audience, do you think out loud? So, Neil, I generally speaking will not play a solo game unless I am live streaming it. And the reason for that, and I won't go into too many details here, but I have various memory issues and it's very apparent when I'm doing a solo game. If you've seen any of my live streams where I'm doing a solo game, you will notice this. But essentially, every time that I've tried playing a solo game where I'm not live streaming it, I get to a point and literally my short-term memory has just gone. And I don't know what I was doing. I don't know what round we're in. I don't know whether I've had one action or two actions. And suddenly I get really frustrated about the fact that I just don't know where I am and usually end up just stopping and putting it away. So, yeah, it's very, very, very rare that I will play a solo game when I'm not streaming it. I can't think of the last time I did. It was probably about maybe a year or two ago where we were sat downstairs in front of TV and I think I had a game set up and I was playing through it. But yeah, I can't quite remember. So, yeah, pretty much most of the time is just when I'm streaming it. So, but if I was playing a solo game and wasn't streaming it, would I think out loud? Probably would, especially now, because I'm so used to talking things through that I wouldn't be able to stop myself. Next question from Gavin. This is another good question. How many games do you have that you will likely never play again, but you keep around for sentimentality's sake? This is such a good question, Gavin. We're going to put this on the guild. So over on the guild, I have a guild on Board Game Geek. I keep mentioning this, and for the last 2 years, I have mentioned that I have a guild on Board Game Geek, but the amount of engagement and traffic on that guild is almost non-existent now, to the point where I'm actually going to stop posting the plans for the week, because the last couple of times I've posted them, there's been absolutely no reaction to it. So, the guild is there, and there are going to be some questions there. And every time these questions get asked, that gets quite a lot of engagement. But the posts that I'm putting up there, don't really get much engagement. So we're going to turn this into a question, which is going to be on the guild, which is, how many games do you have in your collection that you will likely never play again, but you keep for sentimentality's sake? I think it's a really good question because with space being so limited these days, I can totally understand that people will be like, I'm never going to play this again, so I should sell it. Somebody else might want to play it. But there are certain games that I have which I just don't want to get rid of. The original Through the Ages, for example, I am never ever going to play that again. The very, very first printing, which came out in 2006, I think. That's up in the attic. Never going to play that again. The copy of Munchkin that I had when I first met Vicky, we told that story last month or the month before. I'm never going to get rid of that. And there's some really old Games Workshop games in the attic. My old copy of Warlock of Firetop Mountain, which was water damaged and is in bits everywhere. My old copy of Axis and Allies. All of these games that, I loved when I was a lot younger. And there are certain ones. Excuse me, certain ones in my collection that I'm never going to play again that I probably will move on when I get round to when I get round to sorting them out. So that's that, I think. And yes, we're going to ask that question on the guild. So the guild is 2258. Vicky's put a thread to it. Head on over to Board Game Geek, click join. Click subscribe. I think the guild probably has about 1,000 members or 1,500 members. It's just very, very low traffic. So make sure you click the subscribe button when you join the guild, because otherwise you won't see anything on there. Right, next question from Alex. Do I log my plays? And the answer to that is yes. If you've ever watched one of my monthly video logs where I go through all of the games that I played in the month, the only way that I'm able to do that is because I log all of my plays. So yes, I've been logging all of my plays for probably about 5 years or so now. And I pretty much try to log absolutely everything. I'm not one of these people that logs who I played with, what the points were, how long the game took, whether it was raining outside. I just log the game. I played that game on that day. That's it. I don't log much other details about it. Alex's follow-up question is, do I log the setup of Voidfall as a separate game? Which is a good question. Voidfall is a 45 to 60 minute setup, but no, I don't log that as a separate game. And as a follow-up question, Stacey is asking, how many games are in my collection? Now, if you're interested, you can actually find out exactly how many games are in my collection. If you head on over to Board Game Geek and look me up as a user, my username is Paul Grogan, all one word, and you will see on there my entire collection. Now, one of the problems with Board Game Geek and their collection system, which I absolutely hate, I think it's one of the stupidest things that I've ever seen, is if you rate a game or if you've made any comment about a game, even if you don't own that game, it shows up in your collection. So every time you go to Board Game Geek and you click collection, it will not just show you the games that you own, it will actually show you every game that you've commented on because it thinks you're interested enough. So even a game that I played once and absolutely hated, and I rated a 2 out of 10, which is probably higher than it should be for that particular game, it puts in my collection. So what you need to do is you need to click the filter and change it to own every single time. It's just nonsense. It's one of the things that I hate about BGG. But then further from that, there is another filter where you can turn off expansions. So if you were to go to Board Game Geek right now and have a look at my collection, change it to filter own and filter don't include expansions. The current number is 802. Yesterday it was 799, but today three games arrived. So yeah, it's 802 at the moment, which is good, I think, because there was a fear that it was about 800 about 2 or 3 years ago, and it was basically growing and growing, and I didn't have the space. And what I do, for those of you that don't know, is every year I give about 75 games away into charity raffles to help raise money for charity. So I cull about 75-ish games a year, and that generally makes up for the amount of games that I get a year, which is a shocking amount. But, you know, some of the games are massive games, like Agamonia that's arrived recently, and some of them are, you know, Paper Wrap Dungeon, so lit in a little box, things like that. So yeah, I've got games of all shapes and sizes. Anyway, have a look through the collection. Let us know what you think about some of the games that I've got in there. Next question from Bart. When it comes to the setup for solo games, quite a lot of rule books, and I think personally all of them, will say something like, follow the setup for two players except for these changes. I can understand this if the changes are minimal, but otherwise, can you think of a reason for not giving a complete solo setup guide that doesn't have you flicking back and forth through the manual? That is a really good question. And for those of you that are interested, I last night did a solo playthrough of Great Western Trail New Zealand. And as part of this solo playthrough series that I'm doing on a Tuesday evenings, I'm actually setting the game up at the start of the stream. And setting up Great Western Trail solo meant literally referring, it said, set up the game for a two-player game, but with the following changes to the various steps. And it had step 5, do this. Step 8, do this. Step 13, 14, and 15, do this. And I literally had to keep flipping back and forth from the book and going, right, so we follow steps 1, 2, 3, 4, but then for setup 5, we do this instead of this. I didn't find that a problem. And it's only when Bart has asked me this question that has made me actually think about it, because Bart is proposing that, scrap that idea, actually list out all of the setup steps for a solo game. Now, I am no longer a rulebook writer, but I can absolutely see why that would be of an advantage, because otherwise you're having to do exactly what I did last night, which is flip back and forth between the books. The two main reasons that I can think of for doing it. One, space. If you are tight on space and you don't have enough space to fit in all of your stuff within the rulebook, then just saying where the changes are will actually save you a lot of space. And the other reason, and this is a reason rather than excuse, is to avoid duplication when something changes. As a former rulebook writer, what will happen during the process of creating that rulebook is certain things will change. Terminology will change. The designer will say, oh, we're going to call these, you know, Bob now instead of Sheila. Oh, right. Okay. So the rulebook editor's got to go back in and find every reference to this and change it to Bob. And if you're not careful, you might change it in one place and not change it in another place. But so by saying, look, it's exactly the same as that, but with these changes, it means you're going to avoid having that as an issue. But yeah, really, really good question. Next question from Zach. Dinner party at our place. What are we cooking? And what music are we playing when we cook? And then once guests arrive. So, dinner party at our place. What are we cooking? That's over to Vicky, really. So every New Year's Eve for the last 6 years, 7 years, we have hosted a New Year's Eve party where we invite about 12 people round. Vicky cooks 3 meals, 3 desserts, loads and loads of food. And yeah, other than having some people round for games now and again, that is the only kind of dinner party that we do. And it's on New Year's Eve. And we cook a variety of meals. So there's always one vegetarian dish. There's always one fish dish. And there's always one meat dish. But as for what we cook, Vicky basically prepares weeks and weeks before, reading through loads and loads of recipe books and magazines for finding certain ones, and then has to test them out. And unfortunately, I have to then, you know, I've got to eat all of this really tasty food all the time. It's terrible. And then the desserts, got to test out all of the desserts. I've got to sit there all night eating desserts. Really awful. So yeah, it's a variety. If it was up to me, if you're asking me what's my favorite food, it's Mexican. Mexican is my favorite food of choice. What music are we playing while we cook? Well, I don't generally do the cooking, but for me, I would probably have some 80s prog rock playing in the background, something like that, because I'm still stuck in the 80s when it comes to music. And what music will we have on when the guests arrive? I think probably 80s prog rock, whether they like it or not. Next question from Phil. Have I considered having some gaming rules merchandise, e.g., t-shirts, baseball caps, coasters, etc.? I've been thinking about this for like 6 or 7 years. It keeps occurring to me that I should do something like this, but I've never got round to doing it. One of the things that does put me off, and I have been approached in the past by a company who will create t-shirts, and I see this, and again, this is no criticism of anybody. I'm just giving you my honest personal thoughts. I see other content creators going, "Oh, we've teamed up with such and such a company, you know, T-shirt R Us, and you can now buy a branded T-shirt." And I look at it and I'm like, "It's 25 quid, 25 quid for a T-shirt." I'm like, "That's crazy." Now, you know, and it just kind of puts me off the whole thing. If I was to do branded merchandise, I would not want to be selling t-shirts for 25 quid. I don't know. I don't really know how the branded merchandise things work. I've never really done it. The only thing we've got close to it is we do t-shirts for GridCon and we sell them at £10 each because they cost us about £8 each. So we sell them at £10 each. Yeah, some say, oh, maybe £8.50, I think, with the setup fees, something like that. We don't make hardly any money on them. But yeah, I'm not one of these people that is trying to, oh, here's another opportunity to make more money. No, I don't do that. And sometimes when I see some branded merchandise, whether that's right or not, to me, it comes across as potentially that. And I don't want to do that. So, yeah. But anybody who wants branded merchandise, if enough people want it and it's easy to make happen, then I've no problems with it. I just don't want to make a ton of money out of it. Next question from Phil. If you heard about a Jaffa Cake board game coming out, not the 1979 edition, apparently there was a 1979 edition of a Jaffa Cake board game, would I consider buying it or just settling for a pack of Jaffa Cakes instead? Well, to be honest, any board game that comes out that's themed around Jaffa Cakes is very likely to be absolutely rubbish. And therefore, I would probably just buy a pack of Jaffa Cakes instead. But I can assure you that one of my patron supporters would probably buy it for me for my birthday. So I would end up with a copy of it anyway. And then because it was a present, I wouldn't ever be able to sell it. So I'd end up with a copy of it. So, yeah, if there is a Jaffa Cake themed board game coming out, I mean, we could do it as a joke playthrough one night. But yeah. Next question from Phil Byrne. Any plans for UK Games Expo 2024? Yes, I have plans for UK Games Expo this year. I am going to be demoing Galactic Cruise for Dranda Games. So Galactic Cruise, currently my favourite game of this year. It's absolutely an amazing game. It's Kinsengi Games that are the publisher, but Dranda Games are doing the publishing of it in the UK. Dranda Games are a UK-based company. They have a booth at UK Games Expo, and I'm going to be demoing Galactic Cruise for them in the mornings. So if you are interested in getting a demo of Galactic Cruise from me at UK Games Expo, then I will be at the booth Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I think until maybe 1 o'clock on the Friday and Saturday, and maybe until 12:30 on the Sunday, something like that. But swing by. I am taking some bookings for some of the slots for my Patreon supporters. So they are booking some spaces, but there are currently still slots available. So, yeah, if you're interested in that, there will be other people demoing the game there. So if you're interested in Galactic Cruise, but you can't get a demo with me, then there will be other people there as well. Other than that, I have a few meetings with publishers, which aren't actual meetings. They are just, I haven't seen these people for a while, so I'm going to go and, you know, spend time and chat. And I will be hanging out with my friends and my patron supporters, and we'll be playing some games in the afternoons and the evenings. One of the games that I'm very excited about is that I'm going to be getting a copy of a game which isn't coming out until Essen this year, which is Stefan Feld's new game, Civolution. And Deep Print Games have said they're going to send me a copy because I'm going to be working on a video for it. And hopefully it's going to arrive before UK Games Expo, which means that I am going to have a copy of Civolution at UK Games Expo and I will be playing it. And so that's one of the things that I'm looking forward to. There is also the Whose Turn Is It Anyway podcast. People have got a live show happening, but there's only 30 spaces for it. So if I am available and I manage to get in, I will be going to that. That's probably the only show that I'm going to be going to that are there. Next question from Mark. Do I have any experience or opinions on GMT's Coin series of games? Yes. And this has actually been talked about before quite a while ago. So I do have experience with one of those games. I have played Fire in the Lake once because I was really, really keen on the idea and I wanted to try it and I played it and I enjoyed the game. But I do have opinions on those games as well. Bearing in mind, I've only played one of them, which was Fire in the Lake, in that they are extremely good games, but they require you to understand the game, like all games. But because they are very asymmetric, you need to understand what all of the other players are able to do in the game. And the classic example was in our game. I can't remember exactly who it was that I was playing, but I ended up putting a lot of my troops in one particular area on the board. And then the Americans came along and they blanket bombed the entire area. And they went, yeah, you shouldn't have put all of your troops in one area. And I'm like, right, well, if I'd have known you had that ability, then I wouldn't have done that. Now, it's a learning game, and I'm fully okay with that as a learning game. But when those games work best, again, in my opinion, having only played one of them, please tell me if I'm right or wrong, is when everybody actually understands what everybody else can do. Because if you don't, the game doesn't work as intended. So you are going to have people that have put in a bit of time and effort into playing the game a couple of times, and at least understanding what everybody can do, and that's when the games work at their best. A number of my Patreon supporters love these games and have played loads of them. I've been talking about potentially covering one on the channel at some point in the past, but it's not been something that I've ever got round to doing. I love the idea of these games and I appreciate them, respect them. They're just not ones that I've taken the time and effort into learning enough myself. Next question from Ray. What are my thoughts on the latest Asmodee news that they are splitting from the Embracer Group with a hefty €900 million debt around their neck? Right. Honestly, heart on sleeve here, I don't care at all. I have absolutely no interest in any of these big news stories because I don't understand it. It's nothing to do with me, and I would say it doesn't affect me. That's wrong. It does affect me, but I have absolutely no control over any of this, and I don't understand it. And there are things like this happening all the time. Now, there's not big things like this happening all of the time, but this kind of stuff just bounces off me. Other content creators might be recording their own videos talking about it in great detail and how it affects the industry. I don't understand it. I literally don't understand. First of all, I don't understand how a company can be €900 million in debt. That's just absolutely boggling. I just can't understand that whatsoever. I remember that the Embracer Group, whoever they are, whatever they are, bought Asmodee, but now are apparently splitting from Asmodee. As I say, I don't really expend any brain power on this, which is why I'm saying quite bluntly, I don't care, because I don't understand it. It doesn't affect me. That's it. I say it doesn't affect me. So here's something unusual that happened this week about how something like that can affect me. Asmodee, as most people know, is a big group and it owns various studios. Some of those studios I work for. So I have done paid work for Space Cowboys, Pearl Games, who are no longer part of the Asmodee group, but I have done when they were, and Lookout Games. I don't think there's any others. No, I don't think there's any other companies within the Asmodee group that I have done paid work for. But because I have different relationships with all of those different things, at the start of this week, I emailed Plan B Games, because I have a contact at Plan B Games who is Isabella, and I emailed her to say, "Hi Isabella, hope you're doing okay. Just to let you know, I'm doing a playthrough of Great Western Trail New Zealand," which Plan B Games gave me a copy. They gave me a review copy of the game. So I let them know and I said, "Look, I'm doing a playthrough video." And I heard back from somebody at Plan B Games to say, "Thanks very much for this. That's really exciting. But Great Western Trail is no longer part of Plan B Games. It's now part of Lookout Games." And I was like, "What? When did this happen?" And this was news 2 months ago. So I didn't know about this, but because Asmodee is in charge, Asmodee have decided to take Camelup, Great Western Trail, and another one away from Plan B Games and basically make it part of Lookout Games. Now, I don't know or understand the whole politics structure of how that all works. As I say, I don't really care about it, but the reason why I say this might affect me is I have a really good relationship with the people at Lookout Games. I had a good relationship with Plan B Games, but I have a better relationship with Lookout Games. So the fact that this game has moved over from one company to another company, that kind of affects me. So because I had a good relationship with Plan B Games, it's not actually that much different. But let's say I didn't have a good relationship with Plan B Games and that game moved over to Lookout, who I do have a good relationship with, it might be different, for example. So stuff like that might have an impact on me, but it's totally out of my control. Anyway, hopefully I've answered that question enough. Next question from Ray: what are my top three things that make a good board game convention? So I've been having to think about this afternoon. The first thing is it needs to be held in Taunton in Somerset. It needs to happen in November. And it needs to be organised by a brilliant couple of people. They are, for me, the top three things about what makes a good board game convention. Yeah. Seriously, though, I haven't actually thought about a serious answer. What makes a good board game convention? Let me know if you're watching this live or if you're watching this back afterwards. Give me your top three things for what makes a good board game convention. First of all, for me, I would want to see the organisation needs to be good from the point of being able to book tickets, book hotel rooms, communication, and things like that. I would want a professional experience where you know what's going on, you know where it is, you know what time everything's happening. If there are events happening, they are advertised, all sorts of things like that. I would want the general organisation of it to be good. The other thing that makes a good board game convention is the location. And I don't mean location as in where in the country. I mean the venue. The venue for me makes a massive difference to a good board game convention. Now, the venue is actually, there are two parts to it. There is the venue itself, which is out of the organizer's hands. And I'm talking about just the quality, like the air conditioning, the quality of the food, the toilets, how clean they are, that kind of thing. But also how tightly the organisers pack the tables in. I have been to some conventions in the past where the organisers, in order to sell more tickets and get as many people in as they can, have packed the tables in so tight, it's really uncomfortable. And it makes me feel really cramped and claustrophobic and really uncomfortable. And I don't want that. So for me, it would need to be nicely spaced out tables, not packing as many people in as you can. That would be my second thing. And the third thing, top three things that would make, well, the third thing for me, and actually this is the most important one for me, but this is outside of everybody else's control, is the people who I play games with. If I go to a board game convention and there's nobody there that I know, I'm gonna feel lost. I'm gonna feel uncomfortable. So, for me, and this is why I plan most of my games in advance, is the people that I play with and the games that I play. That for me can really make the difference. So if we've got a great venue with amazing food, clean toilets, and I've got, you know, an entire room to myself, that's all great. But if I don't get to play some good games with some good people, then it doesn't really matter. Next question from Henning. Easiest question to answer, cooperative or competitive? And I say this is an easy question to answer because I was asked this question probably about 3 months ago, I think. And the answer is cooperative. And that is the short answer to the question. But what's really interesting is how I have evolved as a gamer, how my gaming taste has evolved as a gamer due to a combination of personal circumstances within my control and personal circumstances not fully within my control. And 10 years ago, I didn't play any cooperative games. And in fact, not only did I not play any cooperative games, I didn't really see the point of cooperative games. And now here we are, and I actually now prefer cooperative games to competitive games. Probably only just, but when I look at some of the amazing gaming experiences that I've had and the games that I'm playing at the moment, let's just take this month as a snapshot. Me and Vicky are currently playing through Tainted Grail, Kings of Ruin. It is a cooperative game. It's fantastic, right? Now that's a combination of the game is fantastic, the narrative is fantastic, and I'm getting to play a game with Vicky, right? Yeah. I'm also playing ISS Vanguard on a Wednesday nights with Rick and Victoria. And I will be, after the Q&A and after food, I will be heading over to Rick's house and I'm going to be playing ISS Vanguard. It is a cooperative game. And I'm absolutely loving it. Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective is a cooperative game. Some of my best gaming experiences have come from that. But then also, I'm going to be playing Great Western Trail. Well, no, I played Great Western Trail solo last night, but Great Western Trail is not a cooperative game. Great Western Trail is a competitive game. It's fantastic. I'm also going to be playing Federation on Friday. Fantastic game. I'm going to be playing Anunnaki. Competitive game. I've also played Voidfall this month. Competitive game. So I'm not saying that competitive games, I don't enjoy them anymore. I enjoy both equally as much, but I'd probably have to say cooperative for me is a slightly better gaming experience because I like the shared experience where we're all on the same page. We're all trying to do something. Next question is another easy one, but I'm going to talk about it a little bit. Terraforming Mars or Terraforming Mars Ares Expedition. The easy one is Terraforming Mars. And why? The why, I've just written because. I do like both games. I do like Terraforming Mars and I do like Terraforming Mars Ares Expedition. I prefer Terraforming Mars just because. I just prefer it as a game. It's very difficult for me to think, okay, give me the top 10 reasons why you prefer Terraforming Mars to Terraforming Mars Ares Expedition. I can't do that. I just prefer Terraforming Mars. I think most people are in the same boat, but I am interested. Is anybody watching this live or back afterwards who prefers Terraforming Mars Ares Expedition to Terraforming Mars? Let me know what you think. Now, there is one thing about Terraforming Mars Ares Expedition that it does have as an advantage over Terraforming Mars, and that is, and this refers quite nicely back to the previous conversation, there is a cooperative mode for Terraforming Mars Ares Expedition. There isn't a cooperative mode for Terraforming Mars. Not an official one, anyway, that I know of. But definitely Terraforming Mars, which, to be honest, is either a top 10 or top 20 game for me. I love Terraforming Mars, and I will never get bored of playing it at all. It's just fantastic. Right, the last question before we hand over to the live questions is also from Ray, and I'm going to assume that this is a typo, because Ray is asking me, is there anything already on my Essen radar for 2025? And have I agreed to do any demos for a publisher at Essen 2025? So, no and no. If you mean Essen 2024, then yes, there are some things on my radar. The number one on my radar is the new Steffenfeld game, Civolution. That is very, very much on my radar for Essen 2024. And have I agreed to demo for a publisher yet? I haven't. And I haven't even got a hotel room yet. So at some point soonish, I need to sort out which publisher I want to do demos for. And to be fair, there's a lot out there that I would like to do demos for. So it will be based on who has me. And I need to sort out accommodation. Right. That's it for the questions on the guild. So thank you very much to everybody for putting those questions in. Just a quick reminder of the contest. Vicky, you can put the link to the contest. The contest is open right now. The contest will close the middle of May. This Q&A, as some of you may have noticed, is a week later than it should be. That's because I forgot to put it in my calendar. And then last week I went, oh, wait a minute. There's the Q&A that we haven't done. So that's why we're doing it this week. But it will be 3 weeks from now-ish. And you've got 3 weeks to enter the contest. And as I say, we only had about 60 people entering the contest. So £50 worth of game vouchers could be yours. All you need to do is click on the link in the form. And the secret word is macaron. Which is not a reference to the French president, okay? It's a food. Is it a dessert or is it a cake? What would you call it? A macaron? Or is it just a macaron? It's a macaron. There you go. Google it if you want. Right, over to the live questions. First one is from Mr. R. Howard. Now, he said why. Does he mean what? I assume you mean what. What is the highest value board game item you own? And I'm assuming that Rick is asking that because Rick very recently had one single board game item worth £450, which he's now sold for £450, I believe. So yeah, Rick was very lucky to get a special, very, very, very rare card from Star Wars Unlimited. And opened it while I was there. And yeah, has sold it for £450. So if you're short on cash at the moment, Rick's doing loans. So if you want to borrow any money, Rick's the person to ask for that. So what is the highest value board game item that I own? I don't know. I mean, let's say board game. Which board game do I own which is worth the most? I don't know. I mean, it's got to be something like Perseverance or Voidfall. Oh, you're pointing to Arkham Horror. Okay, so yeah. So my Arkham Horror card game collection, that is probably cost more than any other single board game. But do you class Arkham Horror? Because if you're going to allow Arkham Horror into this, that's going to be most people's answer. Or something like Magic the Gathering or whatever. So in terms of single board games, we're talking something like Frostpunk, Frosthaven, Perseverance, Voidfall Deluxe Edition, something like that. I don't actually know, but Brett has got a very good point. The special edition of the Arnak expansion, because it's priceless. Yeah, yeah. Too many bones. I'm looking over there because it used to be there. It's not there anymore. It's in the other room. Is it down there? It's down there. So the Too Many Bones trove chest. How much is that worth? Because I've got all of the Unbreakable stuff in there as well. That, in fact, is probably worth more than any of the other ones combined. So, yeah, I think maybe Too Many Bones. If you count the entire Too Many Bones collection in that one box. Ricky's also asking, in a related story, have you ever had a very lucky TCG pull? So back when I used to play CCGs, TCGs, or anything like that, there wasn't this crazy, ultra-rare £500 card. So I'm sure I've had some very lucky pulls back in the day, but not like they are now. Now you can just get stupidly rare cards, and I've not had anything like that. Plus, when I used to play CCG seriously, like Magic the Gathering, I'd be buying four boxes and I'd be going through. I'd spend one night and I'd get a massive dopamine hit. and just yeah, and I'd obviously get a lot of good cards in that. But yeah. Next question from Coramore. Favorite type of tea? Hot, iced, herbal, fruit, or black? Well, I would say just a normal standard English tea, because that is what I drink. I normally have 2 cups of tea a day. But when we were on holiday in Italy, I was drinking a lot of peach tea, and it was really, really nice. So assuming that peach tea, that effectively you buy it, it's like in a it's like in a fruit juice bottle. Assuming that is a tea, then that is my favorite form of tea. Yeah, I need to get some peach tea. I'm sure you can get it in the UK. But yeah, I drank a lot of peach tea when we were in Italy. Good question. Next question from Teen Arcanium. Next purchase is going to be Tricerion, Voidfall, or My Father's Work. In what order would you suggest to buy them and why? Right, well, you don't just want my opinion on this. Let's hand this over to the chat. Out of those three games, which one do you think Team Arcanium should buy first? Tricerion, Voidfall, or My Father's Work? I would personally say Voidfall. That's easy for me because I didn't get on with Tricerion. Tricerion is a really, really odd one because the game is fantastic. I have the game. I've played it a whole bunch of times, but I never want to play it again because something about that game just doesn't click with me. Every time I play it, I just get confused. I come last. I don't know what I'm doing. There's just something about that game which my brain can't seem to deal with. But I know so many people who love the game, and I respect the game, and I think it is a very good game. I just can't do well at it, to the point where I'm not enjoying it because I'm getting frustrated because it just never seems to work out for me. And My Father's Work I haven't played, but I have heard good things about. But what I will tell you is Voidfall isn't for everybody. It is one of my top three games of all time. I think it's an utterly fantastic game, but it's very complicated. It's extremely heavy. It's an hour to set up. And if you don't want all of those things, then it's not the game for you. Also, Voidfall advertises itself as a big epic space 4X game. It's not 4X, it's 3X maybe. But I've played so many games of Voidfall where there has been no player versus player combat, none whatsoever. And if you're coming from a Twilight Imperium background where you want to blow people up with your spaceships and attack each other, Voidfall isn't that. Voidfall is an efficiency puzzle with your own mechanisms where you might have a 3 or 4 hour game with zero player combat. Very, very careful of my words there, because the player interaction in Voidfall is all about the threat of war and the potential conflict and what the players need to do in order to protect themselves should that conflict happen. So it is player interaction, but it's done in a different way. So for me, it's easy. Voidfall, My Father's Work. I am interested in trying My Father's Work because I have heard good things about it. But yes, I've not played it. Next question. Tom Vassell talked about R&R Games, that the owner has never told them what the R&R stands for. But it's easy to guess. Is it rest and relaxation? Do I know? I don't know. I don't have a relationship anymore with R&R Games. The only relationship that I used to have is that I used to see them 3 times a year at conventions. And I would go by and I would wave and I would say hi and we would chat and it, oh, you're all right. Yeah, I'm all right. And everything else. Oh, do you want a copy of our latest game? Yeah, okay. And I would cover some of their games on the channel. But since I don't go to any of the American conventions anymore, I've lost that sort of visual talking relationship that I had with R&R Games. And I've never got round to actually, emailing them or contacting them or anything else. But I do think they do some fantastic games in the past. I've very much enjoyed a lot of their games that they've done. Next question from Andrew. My wife and I are playing one game starting with every letter. Have I got any recommendations for X or Z? I say Z, just in for the Americans. X or Z? Well, X-Bugs, which is the game that I was playing, I wouldn't recommend it. It's awful. It's Tiddlywinks, basically. X. any game recommendation? Again, feel free to put them in the chat. Any game recommendations for the for games starting with X or Z? And I am just going to go to Board Game Geek right now. And I don't know. How can I do this? How can I get a list of games that start with a certain letter? I don't know how to do that on Board Game Geek. I'm going to go to my collection and I'm going to go to the end of my collection to see what games I've got or I've played. And we'll see what's down there. So I'm sure there's got to be an X. No, so I have two games that I have played that start with an X. One of them is X-Bugs, which is the one I've mentioned. And the other one is Xenophile from 1986, which is a Phil Foglio card game with sexually explicit artwork that I played at a convention once in like 1996 and went, what the heck is this? It's an awful, awful game. So they are the only two games which, according to BGG, I've played that start with an X. Apart from a Z, oh, there's loads. Zapotec, really good. Zhanguo, really good. Zombie Dice, not good. Zoolaretto, I've played once. I can't even remember playing Zoolaretto, but I've played Zoolaretto. So Z, no problem. I'd probably, out of those, go with Zapotec. I think Zapotec is an underrated game. It's really, really good, really, really tight. Right, there is a way. On BGG, do an advanced search and input X for the title and submit. Okay, I've seen there's a message in the chat for Zia, Legends of a Drift System, which I have played and I think is awful. Yeah, lots of awful games. Russ is here for Chits and Giggles. Hi, Russ. Thank you for popping in. If it's not too late for a question, it's not. In your opinion, how many days in a row do you think you could play board games during all your waking hours before you'd need to take a break? Honestly, there wouldn't... Right. No, what he's saying is, how many days in a row would I be able to play board games during all of my waking hours? Because I would be able to play board games every single day. No problem. Absolutely no problem whatsoever. And in fact, I probably do, because I play a lot of games regularly on Board Game Arena. At any one moment, I'm in about 5 or 6 asynchronous games. So today, even though I haven't actually played a game yet, I've been playing Great Western Trail and Forest Shuffle during the day, because it's been my turns in those games. I've just finished the game of Forest Shuffle, where I won with a tree strategy, accidentally. But if we're talking about all of my waking hours, so we're talking from like 6 or 7 in the morning, right through to 11 o'clock at night, how many days would I need to do that before taking a break? Bearing in mind I'm getting older and my capacity for things is less than it was when I was in my 20s. Shall we put it to the test? I mean, the other thing as well is life gets in the way. You know, I do need to go to the gym. We do need to go shopping. I do need to spend some time with Vicky. We need to watch some TV. Right. Probably, I'm going to say 5. I could probably do it for 5 days, 4 or 5 days, before I would need to just take a break and just go for a walk or something else. But it's really weird, because the reason why I'd need to take a break is probably because I would start to feel physically wrecked. Mentally, I love playing board games so much, I would be like, right, on to the next one. You know, I'd still be as enthusiastic. I would have to stop and take a break, not because I'm bored or fed up of playing games, just because of the physical necessities of having to do that. It's a good question, Russ. Thank you for popping in. S. James says, are you planning on attending UK Games Expo this year? Hopefully I've mentioned that before. Oh, the show last year. Yes. So S. James came, I did a live Just One show for charity last year where we raised like £600 for charity, and the audience got to pick the words that we were using, and right near the end of the show somebody picked a word, and when that word was shown to the 5 people who were going to be playing, and I was having to guess, None of the people knew what that word meant. So they all had to Google it. And the word was defenestration. And I will never forget that because it was a fun show, but we ended with somebody having to, well, me having to guess defenestration. And I was up on stage with a couple of the guys from the Whose Turn Is It Anyway podcast. And thankfully, I knew the word. I knew what the word meant and I understood the word. So when I saw the clues, which was like Prague, window, politics, murder, and things like that, I was like, well, it's defenestration. It's obvious. The two guys that I was with have never heard of the word and had no idea what it was at all. So that was quite cool. But yes, I am going to UK Games Expo this year. If you want to pop by the Dranda game stand, I will be there, but I'm not doing any actual events or shows or seminars myself this year. Next question from Aidan. Was my copy of Windmill Valley that I taught at Bacon a deluxe copy, or will it come as standard when bought? I'm pretty sure, I don't know, but I don't think there is a deluxe version of Windmill Valley. I thought Windmill Valley, I think that's just the game because it's not like Kickstarter or anything else. It's just straight to retail. So I think the version I had was a prototype, I can tell you that. So the finished version of Windmill Valley, the physical components are going to be different in that copy to the one that I had at Bacon, because the one I had at Bacon was a not a homemade prototype, but it was a purpose-made prototype. So yeah, I wasn't aware that there were going to be two different versions, deluxe and retail. I don't think there are, but if there are, correct me if I'm wrong on that. Next question from Russ, he's going to throw another one. What genre has completely changed your opinion on? And if it hasn't been asked a million times already, biggest gripe with bad rule books. Okay, so first two questions from Russ. First one, what's a genre that you've completely changed your opinion on? I mean, the easiest answer to that is cooperative games, because as I mentioned earlier on, 10 years ago, I didn't see the point of cooperative games. I thought that they were lesser games and not worth playing. So as a wide genre, cooperative games I have definitely changed my opinion on. In terms of other games in the genre, it depends when you whether you're classing genre as theme or genre as in mechanisms. Because one thing that I have slightly cooled on over the years is going from a pure hardcore Euro gamer, where I didn't want any luck or random element in my games, to now playing, enjoying, and accepting some games, not all of them, but some games which have quite a high random element. Now, don't get me wrong, I am not going to start going out and playing some, games with, I'm not going to start playing Warhammer Fantasy Battle and start rolling dice for combat and things like that. But I have played games with dice for combat and I've accepted them. So yeah, probably cooperative games to answer that. Next question, and I could rant for at least an hour about this, but Russ is asking for my biggest gripe with bad rule books and my biggest gripe with rule books. And I am constantly frustrated by this because so many people who are writing rule books think this is a good idea. And I am going to get on my soapbox and I'm going to get on my high horse and I am going to say it is not a good idea. And that is front loading of information. So there are two rule books which I have read recently. I would class both of those rule books as good rule books. Okay? So I'm not saying the rule books are bad, but those rule books are, generally speaking, good rule books. Both of these rule books, I read them because I've created a video on how to play the game. So I read the rule book in such detail in order to be able to create a video on how to play the game. That means that I had to read those rule books really, really in a lot of detail to learn the game absolutely completely, 100%, in order to create the video, right? both of those rule books had one or two pages of key concepts at the start of the rule book, where loads and loads of information is thrown at you before you've even got into the setup. I hate it. I absolutely hate front loading of information in rule books. And here's a fact. I never read those sections in those rule books until afterwards, when I went back to those sections just to check if I'd missed anything. And I hadn't. And what that tells me is those sections are not needed. You could have removed those sections from the rule book and the rule book would have still taught the person how to play the game. And if I sound that, I get getting angry at this. I am, because every single time I get a new rule book and I read and I open it up and it says, right, here's loads and loads and loads of key concepts. Here's some really important stuff that you need to know before playing the game. No, that's called front loading of information. It's bad. Please stop doing it. If you're listening to this and you are a rulebook writer or you're a publisher or you're an editor, stop doing it. Don't do it, right? It's a really, really bad thing to do. And as proof, I literally skipped over that section and I read the rest of the rulebook and then I was able to learn how to play. You do not need those key concepts and they actually cause more problems than benefits. Have it at the back, have it as an appendix or have them as call-out boxes, but don't front load that information to the reader because it overloads them with stuff that they don't need to know and it's confusing for the person reading the rulebook for the first time. Right. In my opinion, in my professional opinion. Next question from James. If you could get any designer, any publisher you wanted to design and publish a game for you, what mechanisms and theme would it have? That's a very good question, but that's a very big question that I'm not sure I'm going to be able to think of an answer on that off the top of my head. So if I could get any designer, there's a lot of designers out there that I think make really good games and design really good games. And there's a lot of designers who I've worked with professionally, who I have a huge amount of respect for. But if I could get any designer to design a game right now, it would have to be Vlaadje Šabatel, because unfortunately, Vlaadje, since the success of Codenames and everything else, he's not created the kind of games that I fell in love with him for. Through the Ages, Mage Knight, Dungeon Lords, and lots of other. Vlaadje was amazing at doing heavy games, but that worked, and he was just amazing at that. And he's not done anything of that style for such a long time. So if I was having my game designed and I had the power to pick a designer to design my game, I would grab Vlaadje because I know that it would then be a good game. I'm not saying if I grabbed any other designer, it wouldn't be a good game. I'm just using it as a selfish excuse to get Vlaadje to design another meaty game. Publisher. Again, there's lots of publishers that do really good work. But I would want to go with a publisher that used good artists, good graphic designers, good quality production, all of those sorts of things. So we'd be looking at somebody like Mind Clash Games, Eagle Griffin Games, something like that, who do really, really good quality design and quality execution and have, you know, good processes with their creation of their stuff. And there's lots of other good publishers out there as well. You know, Garfield Games has got a massively good reputation for producing really good games. So yeah, it would be somebody with a good track record and not publishers that are known for, you know, bad rule books or component issues or something like that. In terms of mechanisms and theme, I don't know, because I'm open to all sorts of ideas and I've got so many ideas in my head of, oh, would it be a campaign game? Would it be a legacy game? Or would it be a one-off game or anything like this? I wouldn't actually be able to think it would have this particular mechanism because I like worker placement, I like deck building, but that's not to say that I would want them in the kind of game that I have. I would potentially want some kind of game where you could just play it as a one-off game and it's a good game, or you have the option of playing it as a campaign where things progress. As always, I've got a million ideas in my head for things that if I had the time and the skill and the inclination that I would want to do. Tomorrow, ping me a message on Slack and I will tell you about the current idea that I've had floating around in my head for the last week, which I can't shake. And like all of the other good ideas floating around in my head, nothing will ever come of it. And I know that, but it's still an idea that's floating around. Next question from D. And how are we doing for time? It's 6:15. So I'm going to say no more questions from this point because I'm getting hungry and we need to go and eat. And then I need to head out and play ISS Vanguard tonight. So thank you very much for all of the questions, but no more questions from now. And I am now going to spend the remaining 15 minutes going through the remaining questions that we've got. So question from D. I have a good question. Okay, well, we'll see. Splendor got removed from Android and iOS, claiming it is too costly to upkeep the app. Okay, how come a clone game with 30 seconds ads after each game does okay? Well, I didn't know that. I did not know that Splendor has been removed from Android and iOS. But what I can tell you from my experience with working with Czech Games Edition on their digital games is it does actually cost quite a lot of time and effort to maintain an app. And there's two main reasons for this. The first reason is there are so many different devices out there now that you can't just create an app. You've got to create an app that works with this size screen, with this size screen, with this, with that. You know, it's so many. And then what happens is the operating system of your phone will be upgraded and suddenly the things that used to work don't work. So you end up having to fix them. So it is a constant battle and it is a constant thing that you need to do. Now, if we take a look at the Splendor app, for example, let's say ballpark figure, it's going to cost you $500 a month to keep that app updated to make sure it will work on all devices that you've sold it for. And let's say you're only selling 10 copies of the app a month. So you are making $50 a month and it's costing you $500 a month. At some point, you need to just draw a line and say, I'm sorry, we cannot maintain this app. I've actually got on my iPad a few games that I bought 5, 6, 7 years ago, maybe even longer, that don't work anymore. They just don't work. The whoever made that app has not maintained it, has not updated it, and that app simply doesn't work anymore. It's always the danger of any digital apps. The question you're asking me is how come a clone game, so somebody has cloned Splendor and has released it on the iOS store, I guess, but it's got 30-second ads after each game, how come that does okay? Again, I think the only reason it does okay is that they're making enough money from those ads to keep it going. I don't know. It's got to be just a money thing. Next question from Aiden. Do I think CGE will ever release a special edition of Lost Ruins of Arnak with all of the pieces and more, with both expansions, the boss can be quite a mess. Do I think CGE will ever do it? I'm not sure. They could, but the last time they released a big box anniversary edition of a game, they used Kickstarter and it didn't go that well for them. I know that there were a lot of problems with it, as is the nature with running things on Kickstarter, that I think it's kind of scared them off. But yeah, I don't know, because that would be quite nice, because I think Arnak is done. I don't think there are plans to release anything more for Arnak. I'm kind of hoping that they don't just go, oh, it's another year, another Arnak expansion, and basically milk it, even though the game's fantastic. So maybe if it is finished, Is it time for a big box edition with deluxe components? I don't know. I'm not sure. Honestly, I don't think they will do that. Watch this space. They might. I don't know. Next question from George. If you could design a board game about designing a board game, what would it be? Well, it's funny you should mention that, George, because I actually did. A long, long time ago, way, way, way back in the day. So we're talking how long ago now? Maybe 30 years ago? How old am I? When was this? Yeah. So somewhere between 25 and 30 years ago, and please let me know if you've heard of the game that I'm about to mention. I got a copy of a game that I think was from Steve Jackson Games, I think, but I might be wrong. And it was a free game that was included as part of a magazine. And I can't even remember what the magazine was, but it was a board gaming magazine about 25, 30 years ago. And I think, and I might be wrong on this, that the game was called File 13. And it was a little game with little cardboard pieces. And it was about making a board game. And at the time, back in the day, I thought, oh, this is great. And basically, I think the process was you were trying to design this board game, and there's all of these things that could go wrong with it, and something would go wrong, and it would end up in File 13 or something like that. I'm going to look it up on Board Game Geek. Is there a game on there called File 13? Because this is, yeah, it's there. 1983, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. Oh my God. Is this it? This is it. File 13, look it up on Board Game Geek. I remember this game. Designed by Tom Wham. That's it. Nothing to do with Steve Jackson Games at all. Tom Wham. It was published in issue 72 of Dragon Magazine in April 1983. And it was republished as. And I had this. I had this game. There it is, File 13. I'm looking at it now. And it's a game that tracks the process of creating a board game. And I remembered that, and I thought this is actually quite a good idea. And the one that I was working on, and I've actually designed this game well enough that it could actually work. All I need to do is actually just make the cards and print it out. But my game wasn't about the production cycle of a game or the design of a game. It was more about you've designed your game, you've now taken it to Essen, and you're trying to get number one on the Fair Play ranking system at Essen. And it was all about the process of going to Essen and having a booth and advertising your game and having people play the game and commenting on the artwork and sort of things like that. Yeah, it was very much a card game. It was a take that against the other players kind of thing. But anyway, yeah, blast from the past there. 1983. It's a good year. Right, two questions left? No, three, four, five questions left. Right. From Max, which Lacerda game is the best for solo and which one is the best for two player, in my opinion? I'm not going to be able to answer that question, Max. Not in the detail that you want, because I haven't played all of them solo. But what I will recommend is Google this. Luke Hector from The Broken Meeple and Mark Dainty from Not Board Gaming did a live show about 2 years ago where they rated all of the Lacerda solo modes. So Google it, check it out, see if you can find it, because they've played all of his games solo. This is before Weather Machine came out, so it is a little outdated. And they've got a lot more information than you. For me, I have played Kanban solo, and I think that was quite a good solo mode, but I've also heard good things about The Gallerist. So yeah, definitely check out their video. Your follow-up question is which ones are the best for two player? I'm not sure. I'm trying to think of the ones that I have played two player. I've played Lisboa two player. I've played On Mars two player. I haven't played his latest one, Inventions. I haven't played that two player yet. I think I've played The Gallerist two player, but I don't normally play two player. Two player is not a player count that I normally play those games at. So yeah, I'm not sure. Not sure about that. Next question. What are my thoughts on Kings of Ruin so far? From FDSFGS7125. My thoughts on Kings of Ruin so far is it's currently either the best game that I'm playing right now or the second best game that I'm playing right now. And me and Vicky played another couple of hours of it on Sunday, and we have had our first boss battle. and it's increased my rating on the game. It's increased my opinions on the game even more. The game is incredible. It took the narrative and the structure of the original Tainted Grail and just made it better. Everything about it is better. The way that the weirdness works and the locations is better. The way that the waystones work is better. The way that the quest structure works is better. The game has an inbuilt hint system, as we've now found. You won't find it until Chapter 3, but that's brilliant as well, because with the original game, certainly on Chapter 7, you just get stuck and you don't know what to do and you're lost. Now, thanks to Kendrick, spoilers, there is this way that you can get help within the game itself. So that's really good. And yeah, the boss battle, I won't spoil it for everybody, but it's really good. But without giving too many spoilers away, you know how the combat system works in Tainted Grail, where you're playing cards in a sequence? Well, what they've done is they've got a boss battle, which is playing cards in the sequence, but every so often, a bit of narrative happens. And basically, you go off in the middle of the battle and you read this bit of narrative, and it's explaining what happens in the fight. And then you go back to the fight, and it's a bit more... It's very cinematic. Really, really good. So, yeah, my thoughts on Kings of Ruin is it's possibly going to be the best gaming experience that I've ever had. Next question from Joseph. Any chance of an Earthborn Rangers playthrough? Oh, Earthborn Rangers. Now, I have done an Earthborn Rangers playthrough for my Patreon supporters. Why wasn't it public? It wasn't public because I didn't feel confident enough with the game in order to do a public playthrough of the game. I was planning to do a public playthrough, but I needed to play the game a few times myself before doing the public playthrough. So I have. If you are one of my Patreon supporters, and you go back a couple of months through Patreon, you will find that there is a playthrough with me and JP playing through it. And it was excellent. It was amazing. Because in the past, I'd only played through the tutorial three times. And it was only when I played that first actual proper game with JP that suddenly I realized how good this game was going to be. And it's one of the most open world experiences that I've had with... Just, here's a world, off you go. There's quests out there. Wander around, do stuff. It was just great. And I've only played like one or two days of it. Unfortunately, other things have taken over. And everything else has got busy. And we're playing Tainted Grail and I'm playing ISS Vanguard. My capacity for playing other games has gone down. Which means Earthborn Rangers, I haven't actually gone back to it. So I want to. I do want to go back to it because it was amazing. But I need to find some time when I am going to be able to go back to it properly and actually not just play it once, but actually play it maybe for a, you know, a 6 or 7 week period or something like that. So yeah, I haven't done a public playthrough, but there is one on the Patreon page if you are a Patreon supporter. Final questions from Rick. How did Vicky make that marshmallow? It was the best thing ever. Have you not posted the recipe yet? Right, Vicky is going to post the recipe to the random channel on Slack later on. Because yes, it was the best thing ever. Absolutely. So yes, there's going to be a recipe on the random channel on Slack tonight for the marshmallows that Vicky made last week. Next question from Peter. How about your Galactic Cruise tutorial and playthrough? How much time do you spend on reading the rulebook so that you can make the video? It really depends on how good the rulebook is. So for my Galactic Cruise tutorial and playthrough, I read through the rulebook once and it took me about, and I was actually learning the game while I was doing it. It took me about 3 or 4 hours. Then I had a practice game of it. Then I demoed the game 2 or 3 times at a local convention. And all of that was before the tutorial and playthrough video. Now, normally I don't go... Normally, I wouldn't do that much preparation, but because Galactic Cruise was fantastic and I loved the game, I ended up playing it a lot more because I wanted to. But for a normal sponsored tutorial and playthrough, it would be normally a read-through of the rulebook, a practice game, a practice teaching game, and then the actual playthrough itself. So it's generally for a 2.5 to 3 hour sponsored playthrough on the channel, it's about 15 hours of total work with all of the preparation that needs to be done in the background. It's not just reading the rule book, it's reading the rule book and a couple of practice games as well. That's for a tutorial and playthrough. For a how to play video, totally different story that we'll come on to another time. And this came in after I'd said no more questions, but because it's Stephen, we're going to make an exception. Stephen is asking, he wants to know if am I still planning to make a how to play video for Inventions Evolution of Ideas? So, Stephen, keep an eye on my, have I not said this? I maybe not have said this. I've been talking about it a lot with my Patreon supporters, and I've been active on the Discord channel, but the video is almost done. I have finished stage two of the video. So yes, I am definitely planning on making a how to play video for Inventions Evolution of Ideas, and it's mostly done. In fact, I might be filming, if I have a good night's sleep tonight, and I wake up tomorrow morning, and I'm in the right zone, I will be filming the final stages, which is the me on camera parts of it. And that will be tomorrow. So the plan is, Stephen, that it will be out by the end of next week to the public, but it may not. It may be the start of the week after, because obviously once I've finished it, it needs to undergo a whole series of checks, and only then, when it's ready, it will be released to the public. But yeah, if you are one of my Patreon supporters and you are on the Slack channel, there is a sneak peek version of it right now if you wanted to watch it, but it just doesn't have the me on camera. The whole video is all done. There's a couple of little errors that I've now fixed this morning. It's just missing the parts with me on camera. And that's the next bit. So yeah, that's done. And then when I've finished that one, I'm going to be working on this one. This is Ezra and... I've been trying to learn how to pronounce this. It's not Nehemiah. It's not Ezra and Nehemiah. It's Ezra and Nehemiah. Anyway, I don't know how to pronounce it, and I don't want to insult anybody by mispronouncing it, which is going to happen. But that's the next how to play video that I will be working on. And I will probably be starting this. Well, I'll be starting this once the Inventions video is done. So yeah, that's that. Right, we're all finished. Thank you very much to everybody for watching. And as mentioned at the start, this was not a sponsored video. I'm not getting paid anything for making this video. All of the advertising revenue goes to charity. So a big thank you to all of my Patreon supporters for supporting the channel and making this happen. And if you like the content that I create and you want to support me, patreon.com/gamingrules. And if you haven't already, don't forget to enter the contest. It costs you nothing. You can enter the contest, and one lucky winner is going to win £50 worth of games vouchers from Gameslaw, which, although that is a UK company, you can enter this contest from anywhere in the world, because with £50, you can have a game and, you know, pay the delivery or whatever. So yes, please enter the contest. The more people we have, the better, except for the people entering the contest. And that's everything. Thank you very much for watching. I will be back later on tonight. If you are a Patreon supporter, ISS Vanguard. That's going to be happening in an hour and a half time. I've got to go and eat, pack, and then head out there. I will see some of you in the chat for that tonight, and I'll see the rest of you next time. Cheers, everyone. Bye-byes.